Good evening and welcome to Lehigh Valley Discourse here on WDIY Allentown. This is NPR in the Lehigh Valley, and tonight I'm your host, John Pierce, going to be chatting with well-known sports writer Jack McCallum. He lives here in the Lehigh Valley, and we're going to be talking about his various activities, which are quite a few. Jack was born in Mays Landing, New Jersey. Jersey boy from way back, Jack.
I am.
Do you still consider yourself a Jersey boy?
Halfway between Pennsylvania and Jersey, that's what I am.
You're right in the river.
Yep.
He has a bachelor's of arts in English from Muhlenberg College. That was 1971. And a master of arts in English literature from Lehigh in 1975. Was the study in English literature specifically England, or was it U.S. also?
It was a little bit of everything. It was kind of, back then, the canon was sort of British and American. You know, you paid homage to the Brits first, and then you got into Fitzgerald and Hemingway. So it was a great course, but pretty standard. I think it's a little more, now the study's a little more diverse, probably than it used to be, for, I think, good reason.
Right, and the same thing has happened in other languages, too, like French used to be completely about France, and now it goes to the islands, and it goes to Belgium and other places. It's kind of the same thing. So Jack worked at the now-defunct Bethlehem Globe Times, and that turned into the Express Times, right?
It did, yes.
And the Morning Call before two short newspaper postings in Baltimore and Philadelphia. He became a full-time writer at Sports Illustrated in 1981. So in Baltimore, it was what paper, Jack?
It was, not the Baltimore Sun, which is the one everyone knows, but the Baltimore News American. Every paper that I worked for, with the exception of the Morning Call, has folded. So I don't know whether that said something about me or something about the newspaper business.
You're asking whether that's cause and effect, right?
Exactly.
I doubt it. And then Philadelphia, what was the paper?
Philadelphia was the Bulletin, which, the one paper now gone. The Inquirer and Daily News is still there. But the Bulletin, all of those were great, great newspapers, but they were afternoon papers. And that has what has died in American culture. There are, as far as I know, almost no afternoon newspapers now. People get their news other places.
As I was growing up in the Chicago area, my father would like to pick up the Chicago Daily News in the afternoon when he got off of work and give the young man a nickel or a dime and take it on the train with him to go home, and now that's gone too.
Exactly.
So the morning papers are running the show right now. Well, Jack has covered almost every sport imaginable, but began specializing in the NBA in the mid-1980s, and that was for Sports Illustrated, wasn't it, Jack?
That's right.
He edited the scorecard section of the magazine and instituted the popular This Week's Sign That the Apocalypse Is Upon Us segment. Jack, I plead ignorance on this one. Bring me up to speed.
Well, it was just kind of decided to do a one-line thing that would sort of just summarize the most absurd thing in sports that happened that week. I mean, it would be like, a team in Britain would hire a stripper as its, main entertainment, or just sort of the absurd thing that would happen that wouldn't need any further explanation. And I mean, it's the one thing I'm proud of. It kind of made its way into the lexicon. I mean, I see a lot of stories now that begin with This Week's Sign, The Apocalypse Is Upon Us, sort of in the sports, a little bit more in the sports realm. So if the one thing I want on my tombstone is I invented that little rubric for Sports Illustrated.
You invented that. That was your creation.
That was, yeah, I just had this idea that you could summarize something absurd in sports under this grand, overwrought headline. But in fact, you know, the thing would be so stupid and meaningless underneath, but it would still, in fact, say a little bit of something about the strange culture that was going on.
Did you have to push very hard at Sports Illustrated to get that accepted by the editors?
What they didn't like was the long headline. They thought it took up too much space. And in fact, it's still a rubric in the magazine, but it's now become, I think, just this week's Sign of the Apocalypse or Sign of the Apocalypse. They decided, why waste three lines of a headline when you can use one?
Jack McCallum was elected to the writer's wing of the Basketball Hall of Fame in 2005. Congratulations on that, Jack.
Well, thank you.
Explain to us, paint us a little picture of the ceremony. Where did you go, and were there others inducted at that same time?
Well, it's up at the Basketball Hall of Fame is in Springfield, Massachusetts, where the game was invented at Springfield College back in, I guess I should know this, 1891. I think Dr. James Naismith nailed up a peach basket, and they began throwing basketballs through it. They did not know, by the way, they did not know enough to cut the bottom out of the basket. There were so few baskets that they took a ladder and removed the basket every time. It was a pretty easy step to cut out the bottom of it, but it was up there, and you know, it's just sort of overwhelming. I mean, your name as a writer is obviously not, there's not a picture of you and all that stuff. It's on a little bit of a trophy. It's called the Kurt Gowdy Award after a famed sportscaster. He was the first one inducted as a media member. But when I take my grandkids up there and we can go up to the third floor, and there's my name. So it was, you know, obviously a overwhelming moment.
Is that at the college that this takes
place?
No,
it's about a couple blocks from the college now. It's its own building. And if you haven't been to the Basketball Hall of Fame, this isn't a paid advertisement for it, but it's really incredible. It's very interactive. You know, you can shoot baskets. There's a lot of video. For a long time, it was sort of this almost quaint museum, whereas the Baseball Hall of Fame and the Football Hall of Fames are amazing, you know, tourist attractions. The Basketball Hall of Fame has gotten to itself at that level. So I urge you to go up there, and you can find my name in about inch and a half type somewhere.
Someday, Jack, I'm going to make the trip and find your name.
Bring your glasses.
Okay. So we are in we're honored today to have Jack McCallum come and do this interview here on Lehigh Valley Discourse, because he lives locally and he is a member of the writer's wing of the Basketball Hall of Fame. Jack has written 10 books, including the New York Times bestseller Dream Team, a novel, and a book about prostate cancer. And right now he's trying to find time to write a young adult novel. Are you still in the throes of that writing?
Every time I make a little note, I see something that I want to put into my head, I run and put it on my computer. I have an idea of a story. I taped all of the National Spelling Bee competition because I just had the idea that part of it could take place there. And I'll get to it. I mean, my goal is to fail in every genre. So pretty much I've been successful in that beside poetry, which I wouldn't even try. So I'm gonna get at it one of these days.
And the other books, now you mentioned a novel. What's the title of the novel?
Novel was called Foul Lines, and I wrote it with another Sports Illustrated writer named John Wertheim, and somebody had once famously commented that two people writing a novel is like three people trying to have a baby. I mean, how is that possible that you can do it? But he and I worked on it. I think we thought that we were not good enough ourselves to write fiction. And between the two of us, I mean, I thought it came out pretty successfully. It did fairly well, but like 10 million other novels, it has, you know, kind of fallen forgotten. But I loved it, the idea of just being able to make stuff up after a career in which basically you write down what other people say and try to make a story out of that. So this was a really enjoyable departure.
This is Jack McCallum, sports writer and also a novelist. And Jack, another book that interests me too that I have not read is the one about prostate cancer. What's the title of that one?
That was called the Prostate Monologues. I had the idea of the title before I did the book. I just thought it was, you know, some kind of humorous take on the vagina monologues.
Right.
And somebody said, well, isn't somebody going to confuse it with the vagina monologues? I said, I hope so. You know, that sold about 5 million copies, and it's still being put on as a play all over the country. But it was about my own, I'm not going to say struggle, my own, you know, sort of bout with prostate cancer, which took place 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Jack has taught at Northampton County Community College and Moravian College, and also at Muhlenberg College. In fact, I sat in on his course last fall, which was entitled Sport, Media, and Culture. And what I was impressed with there, Jack, was that it seemed as if what you did with that course fit in exactly with an undergraduate liberal education curriculum. It was not for people who are fanatics about sports. It was tying in things like racism in sports and gender and how that's coming along for women and so on. So that was really an interesting experience for me. Jack's wife, Donna, and he have two sons. Donna's also a Muhlenberg graduate. Is that the same year as you?
Well, I'm not. It was not exactly the same year, but I can't really say which one. She was a teacher for years in the Parkland School District and the Bethlehem Area School District, now retired.
Right. And you, one of your sons is a college professor. Where?
He's a professor at Middlebury College in Vermont. When he went for his PhD, I used to joke and say it was in the lucrative field of sociology. But then when he got a actual job, I couldn't say that anymore. he's in the sociology department at Middlebury.
Now that was the end of your joke right there.
Yeah, right.
And the interesting thing, I've never met a person who had two sons, one a college professor, the other a farmer. Where is he with his farming?
He's in Bloomsburg, Pennsylvania, and he was a journalism major at Boston University, not following in my footsteps, believe me, but that's just what he was good at. And it just goes to show you, if you have kids out there, you never know what they're going to end up doing, because he, you know, did very well and was a good writer, but just interned at a farm after he was done with college, and really, really, really liked it, and met a girl who had sort of taken the same course, that she had majored in religion or something else, and she interned at a farm, and they just had this idea, and now they're trying to make a go of it as farmers in Bloomsburg.
Wow, what a story. And what kind of farm?
They have a vegetable farm. They farm on about 3 or 4 acres, and they have a CSA, which is a, you know, a sort of a collective group of people that come and purchase vegetables from them, not all year, but you know, it's kind of a new way of looking at agriculture and community sponsored farming, and so far it's been pretty successful. You do not become millionaires doing that, but they're doing okay, and they're doing what they want to do.
Jack McCallum, you have a bachelor's degree in English and a master's degree in English literature. How did you wind up in journalism?
Well, when I went to Muhlenberg, I was pretty much one of those kids that knew what I couldn't major in, which was math and science. And so that kind of left, you know, that's probably a little bit strong. I like to write. I was always pretty successful at it. But I didn't specifically pursue journalism because there was not a journalism course at Muhlenberg. There was, you know, somebody like me who could write. And I had the vague idea that I wanted to teach English or be some kind of writer. And then between my junior and senior year, I went up to Boston for the summer just kind of to mess around a little bit. A girl that I knew was going up to also mess around in Boston. That turned out to be my wife, so I can say that. And I took a course at Boston University in journalism, probably because I thought this is something I could be good at. And, you know, frankly, I was good at it. I mean, it was something, it fit my skill set, not just because it was writing, but because it was going out, talking to people, and being interested in what they had to say. And as it turned out, Boston at that time, well, it's a big city. A lot was going on. There were, even for some nobody journalists from a student, you know, program, you could find really interesting people to talk about. And I was able to do that, and I was really, really good at it from the beginning. It just fit me. And then I talked my way into a job with the Bethlehem Globe-Times when I was back at Muhlenberg. So I pretty much was able, you know, luckily, you always need a break to get into what I should be doing. I'm one of these people that is probably have done what I exactly what I should be doing in life because I can't do that much else.
Well, that's modest of you to say it like that, but it must be a really good feeling to think that you found the career that really was looking for you at the same time.
I do. So. I mean, the one, you know, I could, my minor gripe would be that maybe I would have tried writing fiction earlier, but, you know, when I see some people search for what they want to do, I mean, I do really feel that I kind of found it.
Right. And as a journalist, you had a steady paycheck also. Let's be practical about this. Whereas if you're writing fiction, that's a rough way to make a living.
A steady but meager paycheck. It was a meager paycheck for a while. I mean, journalism's one of those professions you get into, and I suppose you say this trying to make yourself feel good, but it is true. You know, it is something you get into because you like it. I mean, you don't, you know, maybe broadcast journalism, you think, well, I'm going to be on television and make a lot of money someday. You don't really get into print journalism thinking that you're going to make a lot of money out of it. Sort of like, I mean, I compare it very much to teaching, that you think if you're good at it, you're probably going to be able to hold a job. You're probably going to like it, but it's not something that's going to lead you to a lot of money. I mean, I guess it was lucky I stayed in it long enough to get to a place where you could make a little bit of money anyway.
Right. This is Jack McCallum, sports writer and novelist. We are chatting with him this evening on Lehigh Valley Discourse. Time for us to take a break and stay right with us. We'll be right back.
Spread the word about your organization or business to a well-informed audience. Become an underwriter with WDIY. Our lineup of NPR news and locally produced music programs reaches thousands of locally engaged listeners each day. Underwriting on WDIY is an affordable way to enhance your image and to provide information about your services to people who care. For more information, visit wdiy.org.
We're back with Jack McCallum here on Lehigh Valley Discourse, and we're talking sports today because he is an eminent sports writer. He's a member of the Basketball Hall of Fame in Springfield, Massachusetts. And Jack has written a number of books. He's also a novelist, but I think best known for his sports writing and best known for his being the point man for the NBA at Sports Illustrated, Jack, for how many years?
Well, probably on and off for almost 20 years, probably. And it was fortunate enough that it was during the, quote, golden age of the NBA. You know, I first started doing it during the Jordan, during the Michael Magic Larry years, you know, these guys that are so famous, you only need one name to describe them. And part of the journalism, part of the trick is to, you know, I always joke, but it's not really a joke, that you're only as good as your material. I mean, if you're writing about interesting people that people want to read about, you sort of have a leg up on the competition, and that's what I was fortunate enough to have done.
And so that was in the 80s and 90s. Now, I met Jack McCallum when I drove some students that he was teaching at Muhlenberg College at the time. This would be 5 or 6 years ago?
Probably 7 or 8 years ago now, I think, yeah.
That we went into the offices of Sports Illustrated. So it's up on about the 20th floor of the Time Life building in New York City, in Manhattan. And he took the class up there, and it was just fascinating to see all the I was going to say commotion, but just the, it was orderly, but all the movement around the office, people running around. Now, this was on a Sunday, and they had to put the issue to bed on Monday. So this was crunch time, and I was expecting when we went in, I was asking myself, why is he taking us in on a Sunday? Is it that we're not going to get in anybody's way because the people are off naturally on a Sunday? And we go in there, and here's this office just buzzing with activity. So what was it like to be a writer in that atmosphere?
Well, Sunday is the Sports Illustrated was the ultimate anti-biblical place because everything happened on Sunday. It was, as you said, first of all, it's, you know, all sports to a certain extent is a weekend operation because, you know, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. I mean, football game Sunday, college football game Saturday. Most of the action happens on the weekend. So Sports Illustrated's, the weird thing about it was that when you worked there, you were in the office on Sunday. If you had an office job, you could conceivably be in there from 9 o'clock in the morning until 2 or 3 in the morning, you know, Monday morning, Ooh. Because that was the big push. And then you came in on Monday morning and kind of swept everything up. As a writer, you are not exposed to that. When I first got there, and for most of my career there, you're not in the office. When you're a writer, you know, you're writing in, where are you? You're in Dallas, you're in Houston, you're in Los Angeles. You have no idea what goes on in the office. But in the early 90s, they asked me to come edit Scorecard. That's an office job. And back then, you know, I told the guy, well, I can't commute from Bethlehem. It's just too long. You can't wait at the Lincoln Tunnel every morning. Well, fortunately, back then, you could spend an infinite amount of money at Sports Illustrated. You could, you know, you couldn't put down enough on your expense account. So I would just stay overnight. I mean, I would stay in hotels in New York. I'd go in Thursday morning, stay overnight Thursday night, stay overnight Sunday night. So it wasn't a problem. And you get exposed to a whole different thing when you're an office person or when you're a writer. Each of them have their own different pressures, but I think it was really good for me as a writer to understand how the other half lives, not to be just a guy that called in your story and started complaining about how the editors have messed it up, when in point of fact, you see this kind of crunch time mentality that goes on when you work in the office under a deadline.
Well, Jack, one thing that intrigues me is the relationship between the writer and the editor. Would you always have the same editor? Would there be various editors for a story that you would turn in?
Well, the answer to that is both. In the case of Sports Illustrated, you know, you would have like if I was writing basketball, you'd have an NBA editor. But Sports Illustrated was very, very, very editor heavy. You'd turn in your story. Your individual editor would read it. It would get passed on to somebody called a blue pencil, which did the first edit on it. It would get passed to a red pencil, which is the second edit. It would get passed then to the fact checker, then back to your editor. It was sort of this multi-layer process that went on, which sometimes caught inaccuracies. Other times may have weaned some of the what you thought original flourishes off of the story. But the end of the day, if you ended up being a person there who they respected and thought, you know, could do the job, they kept their hands off of it pretty much. But when I talk to students, I tell them that, you know, a couple different things, that when you're, don't get mad at me as a professor or teacher when I edit your stuff, because the same thing happened to me. And secondly, this is probably too much for this conversation, but when things became internet heavy, that process of people combing through your story and two or three different people checking it for inaccuracies, that has gone out the window, that it's essentially your keyboard to the internet. And it's, you know, it's a really a fundamental, I think, difference in journalism, with some weaknesses because of that, and also some strengths, perhaps.
All right. So there would never be a story that you would turn in that would not be seen by an editor first. That's automatic?
Oh, absolutely never. I mean, and the good thing about Sports Illustrated, I think it was not unique. I mean, the New Yorker famously has fact checkers, but Sports Illustrated got its facts checked very, very, very thoroughly. There was just one person on that story who was, their job was, where'd you get this from? Oh, I thought this was the case back in 1993. Well, my research showed that in 1995 this happened, and you said that. Who told you that? They wouldn't check your direct quotes. If you quoted someone directly, they assumed you had the honesty to have done that correctly. But everything else in that story was gone over with a fine-tooth comb.
When you gave direct quotes from athletes, and their English might be what we would call substandard, would you clean that up, or would you quote it exactly the way they said it?
I pretty much was under the maybe this is a dirty little secret of journalism, but if you quote an athlete or anyone directly with how they talk, and you make it, you throw in a few ain'ts, or you don't have an agreement between the subject and the verb, you are announcing to the public, this person is dumb. And I don't think that's fair to do. I wrote a book in which I quoted Larry Bird in his kind of Hoosier twang, and it made it sound like I was saying he was dumb. And what I always tell my students is, unless you're William Faulkner, writing, from Yoknafatafa County, don't do it, because you will not do it correctly. And all you're doing is sort of putting forth this presumption that athletes are dumb, when in point of fact, they're not. They may not be schooled in English as well as you are, but there they are being interviewed with a towel around them after they've played, this heartbreaking game. You try that circumstance. Try talking to somebody like that.
And the athlete who just lost the game is irate anyway because of the loss.
Exactly. So. I mean, I think that's part of the, keeping your work in context, that you have to understand circumstances under which people are questioned. And I think it's fair in many cases if the Vice President of the United States, as with Dan Quayle, couldn't spell potato or tomato or whatever it was, that's fair game. If you put that in front of an athlete standing in front of his locker, I think it's a different case.
Exactly. Good point. This is Jack McCallum. We're chatting here about his career as a journalist and many years at Sports Illustrated. Jack, you're a writer. I guess, would it be fair to say you're driven to write? You need to write?
I would say that's probably true. I mean, my wife always says when I'm finished, and I just did finish a book that I did with Jim Boeheim, the Syracuse coach, and it's sort of like I just get antsy until I start thinking about the next thing that I'm going to do. And, I can't say that I'm obsessed with it, and I can't be happy not doing anything else, but I'm not going to be, I'm not going to be fixing the bird feeder. I'm not going to be redoing the house. I might watch the 10-hour Law & Order rerun if I'm not doing something. My wife seems able to find these little things to do. I can't find little things to do. I can only I can either do nothing, or I have to have a book, some kind of book project.
And what drove you to want to write about sports particularly?
Well, it happened when I went to the Globe Times for my job interview halfway through my senior year at Muhlenberg. It happened that the job was half in sports and half I was the Lehigh County courthouse reporter. And I found out that I was terrible as the Lehigh County courthouse reporter, but I was pretty good in sports. And I mean, in retrospect, if there is a quote ideal background for sports writing, I probably had it. I understood sports. I grew up loving sports. My father and I played catch. I was decent at sports. I played basketball and baseball in high school, played for a year of basketball at Muhlenberg, but I was never really, great, that I sort of understood I had experience of being the worst player on the team, and I had experience of being one of the better players on the team. So I kind of understood sports, you know, fundamentally. And probably you don't see many people in sports writing who are great, great, great athletes. There's a couple exceptions. And you rarely see somebody in sports writing who didn't like sports. Right. I mean, I think you have to like it. I mean, sports people that say, you know, sports is, you know, kind of like stupid. I just like writing about the people. you have to have some appreciation and love of sports to do this. So I think I just had the ideal background for it.
Is there a reason particularly that you wound up writing more about the NBA at Sports Illustrated rather than another sport?
It was almost, I just think if I got one break in life, it wasn't like I went to Sports Illustrated and said, I really need to do the NBA. This is what I really wanted to do. I didn't have that. And, you know, in the mid-80s, he just kind of handed the NBA beat to me. And it turned out that basketball is the sport I know the best. It's the sport that I was probably the best at. I probably understand it the most. It had the best season. You had summers off, you know, when I could play with my kids and take vacations and things like that. It's become less of a summer off thing, by the way. That's a whole other story. But so it turned out, once again, one of those lucky breaks that I got into the profession that I should be doing. And within that profession, I got into the sport that I probably should be writing about.
That you knew the best.
Yeah.
But you have written about, you said, a variety of sports. Was that at Sports Illustrated or was that before?
You're, you know, writing at the Bethlehem Globe Times, I mean, obviously you cover everything. I ended up at the Globe Times because of where we're at here in the Lehigh Valley. I ended up being the wrestling expert, you know, because the high school wrestling here was so great. When I got to sports and in Baltimore, I covered the Baltimore Colts. I was the football writer. When I got to the Philadelphia Bulletin, I was going to cover the Philadelphia Phillies. I was going to be the beat guy for the Phillies. So it was sort of this whole general, you know, bag that I had. When I got to Sports Illustrated, I did all kinds of weird features. I mean, the way I got noticed there was I wrote a feature on a local softball pitcher around here, which some of your listeners will know, Ty Stofflet, who is the immortal softball pitcher, maybe the greatest softball pitcher of all time. I wrote a feature for that Sports Illustrated bought, and that's kind of how I made my entree there. So, you know, it's kind of been all different kinds of sports. I still love all kinds of sports, but basketball is probably the one where I was the most home in.
If you had to choose one sport to watch a game, let's say on TV, or to go to the field or the stadium, would it be basketball?
That's a good question. I probably, to go to the stadium, I still remember, you know, going to the baseball games with my father, you know, would still hope, look forward in a few years to take in my grandson, you know, to a baseball game. So probably to go to a game and experience it live, probably baseball would still be as good as anything. But as I get older, my main complaint is everything takes too long. I mean, every game is too damn long. You know, I used to joke that the perfect thing was bowling. You know, it was 10 frames. You know,
well, there was something in the news some months ago about a baseball game that had and I heard the announcer say 3 hours and 17 minutes, and I thought, well, that's what the length of the game. That was the rain delay, and then they continued the game after that.
Wow.
So sometimes it gets a little bit silly.
Yeah.
But baseball has that allure about it of not having the clock running. And it's more pastoral, and it's more sit around and chat a little bit while they're doing things. By the way, when we come back from our break, I want to ask you what you think are the most boring moments in sports.
All right.
I have the correct answers, Jack.
Okay.
So we'll see how you do. This is Lehigh Valley Discourse. I'm your host, John Pierce, this evening, and I'm chatting with Jack McCallum, sports writer, who lives here in the Lehigh Valley. Time for another break. We'll be back shortly.
You're listening to WDIY, Lehigh Valley's community NPR station. If you appreciate and value the programming we provide, including NPR's in-depth news coverage, our local public affairs programs, and the diverse mix of music we broadcast each day, please consider becoming a member. Membership is our most important source of revenue. We can't do it without you. You can make a secure donation online at wdiy.org. That's wdiy.org. And thanks for your support.
Celtic Fair, a celebration of Celtic music and culture, from its roots in Ireland, Scotland, Wales, Galicia, and Brittany, to its branches in Australia, Cape Breton, Canada, Chicago, New York, Philadelphia, and the Lehigh Valley. Bringing you music, interviews, and a weekly culture calendar every Thursday from 7 to 9 on WDIY Allentown, listener-supported community public radio.
We're back with Jack McCallum. I'm John Pierce, your host here on Lehigh Valley Discourse. Jack, I asked you to consider the most boring moments during a sporting event, and I'm going to throw one out at you. One is the change of pitchers in baseball. Another one is intentional walk in baseball. So do you have any other goodies for me?
I would say, you know, since I covered mostly basketball, the exchange of timeouts in the final minute of a basketball game, I think they should probably, there was some push to limit it to one timeout per team in the final 2 or 3 minutes, because coaches take a timeout, they send their team onto the court, and they see what alignment the other team is using. Immediately, that coach calls a timeout to try to counteract it. In point of fact, the players are going to – look, there's good coaches and bad coaches with strategy, but the players are basically going to react anyway. It's a reaction sport. So I would put that right up there. The time the video review in football has just become interminable also, but that's a genie you cannot put back in the bottle. The movement in sports is going to be toward that, because what happens now with the newly reviewed video in baseball and basketball, the things that you are not allowed to review are becoming the issues. Well, if you're reviewing that, why aren't you reviewing? You missed something else. So I think it's going to be probably longer. I think events are going to get longer, and they're going to have to take a look at shortening the time between innings, for example, or as you say, the intentional walk, you know. But so many of these things in sports are part of the tradition. They're part of the grandpa did it that way and dad did it that way. So why do you want to change?
Particularly baseball.
There's no question, particularly baseball, which is why I like to watch it at a park. But honestly, it's very difficult for me to turn on a baseball game at 7 o'clock. I guarantee you I'll be watching something else by 7:30.
And another point about basketball, too, is in the last couple of minutes when all they're doing is shooting free throws. As soon as the ball comes in, foul, and get them the free throw. That tends to turn me off.
No question.
I think the best example I can think of where the replay works so well is tennis. Because really all you're trying to determine is the ball in or out?
Right.
So it's not all this gray area. What can you call? What can you not challenge? And so on. And it's instantaneous. There's one of the competitions where they do it automatically. I know it's the U.S. Open, where they have that electronic thing that shows
right
that the ball was in or out. And then at some other competitions, they don't allow that. But you're right. It's something that's coming on more and more, I think, as technology advances. The two sports that I really like for their rapidity and lack of timeout are soccer and hockey. Why does, in basketball, does the referee have to handle the ball every time There's a timeout, and then he has to hand it to the player again to start the play. In soccer, there's a foul. The player puts the ball down. The referee doesn't even touch it. And they kick it, and they're off again. Mm-hmm. In hockey, they're changing on the fly. While they're still playing, they have two or three players going to the bench and coming off the bench. I think that's great for those sports.
Well, hockey is, in many ways, in my opinion, the best refereed sport. I mean, because, I mean, think about what these guys do. They're also on skates.
That's right.
You know? I mean, and if you compared soccer to basketball, there's three basketball officials in a court that's 94 by 50 feet, 60 feet. Now, I should know this, obviously. And in soccer, you know, there's basically one guy, you know, the referee. There's some linesmen, a couple linesmen, but he's controlling this field, which is bigger than a football field. So that has something to do with it. This three referees containing a small space, that has something to do with the fact that they're always, you know, handling the ball. But.
Right. Jack McCallum has interviewed many very famous sports personalities, athletes. Jack, is it at all intimidating to hold an interview with a great star?
Not really. You know, I always tell my students that the gap in journalism is really not one between, you know, fame. It's really about age. I think it's very, very the most difficult thing for a young journalist is to get an assignment when you're 21, 22 years old and then being asked to interview somebody famous. I mean, I always tell the story that I was at the Globe Times and I was a senior in college and I was sent up to interview the Lehigh football coach, Fred Dunlap. It was like I was a altar boy going to meet the Pope. I mean, it was holy smoke, you know. By the time I got to SI, I mean, and started covering the NBA, I was in my early 30s. And, you know, yeah, the first time you go to meet Jordan or Bird, I suppose it's, I don't want to use the word intimidating. You have to think about it a little bit. But then you start talking, you're generally, after you reach a certain age in this business, older than the people you're talking about. Your life experience in many ways has been more varied than theirs has. So I don't think that doesn't become a problem after a while. The main problem with connecting with famous people and what I experienced in writing the Dream Team book was you have to get them on your plane, that you have to get them sitting still for a moment at a table where they're only paying attention to you, where they're not listening to their cell phone, where they're not having people come up to bother them. That is the challenge of interviewing, is to get that person to concentrate just on what you're asking them, whether it be for 15 minutes or a half hour or, in some cases, an hour. That's the challenge.
And after you've interviewed some of these very, very famous athletes, would they always give you an autograph if you ask for it?
Oh, I couldn't get a autograph from them, though.
You didn't even ask
no, no,
them for it?
No, I've never. Okay. When my back in the Dream Team was 1992, my kids were 12, 10 years old around then, and we went out to, I took them out to Portland where the Dream Team was playing a game, and I said, okay, you're on your own. I'm not getting interviews for you. Now, if Barkley, I remember Charles Barkley went by and he's got 100 people around him. I said, Charles, there's my kids. You know, if you could just sign an autograph for him. But I couldn't really do it myself because, you know, number one, it puts you on a different, makes you a fan rather than a journalist. And number two, if you then write something that they didn't like, which sometimes happens, and then they could say, hey, you know, you ripped me, and then you got an autograph from me. It's probably not fair. So I don't have a single autograph in my collection. I have a couple pictures of me with athletes, but that's kind of like somebody else took them, you know, and gave them to me. So you sort of try to keep that distinction between being a fan and a journalist.
Were you ever asked for your autograph by people?
Well, it was funny. I was over in I traveled to Russia with the Atlanta Hawks back in the summer of 1988. And basketball, you know, we were in some areas of Russia where they didn't exactly even know who these guys were. They just knew they saw suddenly 10 6'8" African Americans, you know, pouring out of this bus. And who was I? They must have thought that I was a coach or something. So I had kids rushing up to get my autograph. To this day, they're going, Jack McCallum, I do not know. I have no idea who this guy is, but he was on trip. It was a bad Russian accent, by the way.
But it's been many years also.
Yes.
You've mentioned the title of this, the most famous book that you've written, Dream Team. Let's explain what that is. What was the Dream Team?
Well, back in 1992, it was the first time that the Olympics had always been barred specifically to NBA players. In 1988, we only finished with the bronze medal in Seoul, and that was because we had a team of collegians. The world was catching up. You know, you could put a team from Yugoslavia that was better than a team from the United States, a team of collegians. Russia, the same thing. Well, it's a long story as to how it happened, but at any rate, in 1992 was going to be the first year that NBA players were going to be allowed to play together in the Olympics. Moreover, it happened to encapsulate this time that was the golden age of basketball, that on this team was going to be probably arguably the three best-known players of all time, Michael Jordan, Magic Johnson, Larry Bird, not to mention every other big star in the NBA. It became kind of this perfect storm of celebrity and crossover marketing, and not to mention basketball talent. It created this phenomenon, the likes of which I've never seen. It kind of overtook the Olympics a little bit, which was unfortunate.
Now, my understanding is that in former years, the rule for the Olympics was that they had to be amateur athletes in all sports.
Yeah, but that was, of course, more in the telling than in the execution because, for example, every other good basketball team had professional players on it. They just weren't in the NBA. They were players from, there was a good Italian league. There was a good Spanish league. And in point of fact, you know, the Yugoslavs, three or four of those players ended up playing in the NBA. So the idea that it was all amateurs in the Olympics is just, you know, was absurd. So when the NBA players finally got in it, it was more or less this kind of overkill of, talent and money and everything else. But it kind of got normalized. I mean, now these days we have LeBron James and Dwayne Wade and Kevin Durant playing for a national team. Yeah, they've won the last two gold medals, but it hasn't been easy. They've basically just beat Spain. So basketball has, you know, kind of caught up almost around the world.
Yes, indeed. In Europe, it's very, very big. Jack, in your years of covering the NBA, I want to ask you about travel and how that might have affected you, your family, and so on. I've heard it said that of the professional sports, the NBA has the most grueling travel schedule because of playing one night here and one night there. What was your experience with that?
Well, that's true. I mean, football, from a standpoint of being a human being and a journalist, to cover football is the best thing. There's one game a week. You travel to it, you come home. I covered stayed on the beat with the Baltimore Colts one year. Baseball has 162 games, but literally twice as many as basketball. However, you went to a town and you stayed there. It was kind of like, well, we encamped for a few days. Basketball, you were never in the same place. And in one respect, it was kind of easier to do your job because when I first started doing it, the teams flew commercial. So you could do a lot of interviews if you got on the same flight with them. If you could convince them to come back in the peasant coach class, they were usually up front, but some of them, they couldn't even fit. I remember talking to Daryl Dawkins, who was a giant of a man, 6'11", 300 pounds. And Daryl and I were crammed into two seats on a U.S. Air flight. So now they started chartering. So the challenge right after a game, they would leave, and you were not allowed on the charter, obviously. So the challenge in the NBA became finding that time, you know, to get to the person. And I never liked to do interviews in a locker room because everybody else, you know, was around all the time. I mean, I didn't want everybody else hearing my questions. Or a press conference, I never ask a question because why do I want everybody to copy down the question that I want an answer to? So it kind of became the challenge to try to get them at breakfast or try to have a 15-minute lunch with them or something like that, or wait for them out by the bus. But in many ways, yeah, that was the challenge of the NBA. And to cover this, you know, and still have a home life, I took a lot of red-eye flights from California, put it that way.
Right. So during the basketball season, which goes from September?
Basically, training camp always used to be October 1st, and then they would play the – it got later and later, like everything else in sports. You know, it got to be the last week of June.
Right.
But I – you know, working for Sports Illustrated, I never had to – I don't want to exaggerate the drudgery of my schedule because – you know, you'd have weeks that you didn't work. I mean, you would do a story. Maybe you'd do a feature story ahead of time, and that week you wouldn't work. So it wasn't like every single week I was getting on an airplane. And the joke was my mother-in-law, when I would miss something, she would say, "Oh, you're never here for anything because you're always traveling." Then when I would be there, she would say to me, "Do you ever work? What's your schedule?" So it was a very, very, very irregular schedule. But I think at the end of the day, I think it was able to be pretty normalized between what I was able to get to with my kids. I mean, put it this way, they never really seemed to miss me. If you ask them later, "Oh, well, Dad wasn't around a lot," they'd all go, "What do you mean? It seemed like he was here all the time," you know. So
Jack, when you interviewed famous people, did you ever tick anybody off to the point that he would not do any more interviews with you?
Yes, I did. The quick answer to that is yes. Probably the only time I almost got into a physical confrontation was with Isaiah Thomas. You know, he asked me not to ask him about something, and, you know, at the end of the interview, I sort of persisted that we were going to do it, and you know, it came to kind of a little bit of a potentially ugly scene. As a journalist, you're always sort of pushing to try to get information because you never really can be sure if somebody will honestly start talking about something that they might be reluctant to otherwise talk about. But I think, you know, probably looking back, that I was probably able to keep the balance pretty good between not having everyone get irritated at me and trying to get the information that I was trying to get.
Do you have a favorite sports writer that you like to read?
Well, there's a lot of guys at Sports Illustrated. I mean, one, you know, NPR guy was, you know, obviously Frank DeFord is one of the, you know, in the Sports Illustrated Mount Rushmore of sports writers, the way Frank did things.
He's on our station every Wednesday morning.
Oh, yeah. No, yes. I know that. He says Frank was as good as they get, as good as you could get for doing those long profile type of stories.
Right. Jack McCallum, I thank you very much for coming by our microphones here at WDIY and chatting with us about your fascinating career as a sports writer. Jack is also a novelist and currently still writing. Your wife attests to that, correct?
Well, she thinks I'm more. I'm usually scribbling on something anyway. I'm not exactly sure what. But.
So this has been a Lehigh Valley Discourse. Jack McCallum was our guest today. And Jack, we appreciate all the insights that you have given us about Sports Illustrated, which was a really probably the pinnacle of your career those years. And coming right here from the Lehigh Valley, originally a Jersey boy, but he found his way across the river, and we're very grateful that he did. So the best to you in the future, Jack.
Thanks for having me, John.
This has been Lehigh Valley Discourse. Until we meet again, remember to be gentle with your neighbor.